This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll focus on a nonprofit that helps get medical care for dogs and cats when the owners can't afford the cost of veterinary care.
Obviously, pets are part of their family, and we can all relate to that, and costs can start adding up, and we can help save your best friend, your family member.
Also, on Playing with Food, you'll hear a popular episode from our archives.
We grate the potatoes, and then we soak them in an ice bath. What that does is removes a lot of the potato starch.
Oh, look at that.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, December 6th. I'm Carol Tangeman. A new documentary, which recently aired at the Ojai Film Festival, chronicles the life of journalist Ivor Davis, who was a witness to pivotal moments in Southern California and U.S. history. He was an international correspondent for the London Daily Express. KCBX intern Brett Volrath spoke to Davis about his life and reporting.
According to the Pew Research Center, the chance of witnessing another human being murdered is less than a percent of a percent. It would be rarer still to witness the murder of someone as famous as the brother of a U.S. president. And yet, that event is just one of many in the life of journalist and author Ivor Davis.
Bobby Kennedy was assassinated at the Ambassador Hotel kitchen, and I was there to see it. So I was a very lucky, odd fellow because I was around when a lot of these stories unfolded, and I had a front row seat to most of them.
After the war, Davis moved to California, despite knowing nobody there, and he received an offer from the London Daily Express to write for their new West Coast bureau. It was here that he received his first big opportunity.
In 1964, my editor called me and said, "You've got to join the boys in San Francisco." And I said, "Who are the boys?" He said, "The Beatles, silly."
A meeting with their manager got Davis exclusive access to the Beatles' apartment while they were on tour. Here, he was able to listen to first and second drafts of their songs and even played games with some of them. But darker moments followed. His next big assignment came in 1965 to cover the Watts riots in downtown Los Angeles.
I was scared out of my mind because I hid in the gutter under the car while snipers were shooting at us, and Harry Benson, this intrepid, crazy photographer, was running around taking pictures. And I was scared. And finally, after about 30 minutes, Harry jumped back in the car. I jumped back in my car, and we roared out of Watts.
3 years later, in 1968, came a chance encounter with assassination.
Shortly before midnight at the Ambassador Hotel, Bobby makes a short speech in the ballroom, and he's going to go through the kitchen to another area where he's going to have a press conference. So I follow him. Suddenly I hear balloons popping. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Immediately there's somebody screaming. I push my way into the kitchen, and there on the floor is Bobby Kennedy.
And then, in 1969, he was one of the first on the scene of the murder of Sharon Tate, along with four others, at her house on Cielo Drive.
I was told to go to a house in Beverly Hills, in a canyon, because there had been, they believed, some murders. So I used Phil's phone to call my story in, and Philip said to me, "I know who lives there, the actress Sharon Tate, her husband, the film director, Roman Polanski, and they live with a bunch of friends." And then I realized, you know, good heavens, were they all murdered?
Davis would later go on to cover the arrests and trials of the Manson family members who carried out the murders. During his investigation, things ended up coming back around to the start of his career.
It was a kind of a coming together again. The most infamous murder of the 20th century, which had been orchestrated, apparently, by the Beatle music.
When asked about what he's considered the best part of his career, Davis gave a humble answer.
The highlight of my career is marrying my late wife. Oh, lucky man was I. And then I've got great kids, and I have terrific grandchildren.
A documentary about his life, directed by filmmaker John Zills, premiered at the Ojai Film Festival on November 7th. For KCBX News, I'm Brett Volrath.
Up next, the nonprofit story. Your host, Dr. Consuelo Mukes, speaks with Eric Rehm, Executive Director of Animals in Need Fund.
Eric, welcome to the nonprofit story.
Thank you for having me.
I'm excited to have you. I think you have an organization that's been around for a while, but maybe a lot of people don't know about you. So let's start off by you just giving us some background on the Animals in Need Fund and tell us where you're located and all those other good things.
So Animals in Need Fund started about 8 or 9 years ago by Robin Schroyer and Ben Trogdon, who were running the Nipomo Dog and Cat Hospital at the time. And they wanted something that would help them both subsidize low-cost spays and neuters, but also to give the veterinary staff a way to help people who might not be able to afford the veterinary care that their pets needed. And so Animals in Need Fund does a few things. One of them is spays and neuters. We do fostering, and we also provide either grants in an emergency situation or no-interest loans in a non-emergency situation for people who need help affording veterinary care for their pets.
And I think you focus on dogs and cats only. Is that correct?
Yes, that's our focus at the moment.
And why do you think there's a need, or what was the need that you found that keeps this program going?
I think there's a lot of people who, obviously, pets are part of their family, and we can all relate to that. And sometimes if something goes wrong, it's hard to know exactly what it is. And if you take them in, the bills can start adding up, costs can start adding up, and you still want to help them. And sometimes people run into a barrier where there just isn't any money to help them anymore. And so that's where we come in, and we can help save your best friend, your family member, all of that. And it's very rewarding.
Now, you talked about spaying and neutering, but it sounds like you do that, but do you also do more?
Yes, we started at Nipomo Dog and Cat Hospital, and we've been expanding throughout other veterinary hospitals in the county recently in the last few months. But if people do need financial assistance, like I said, we can provide a grant if it's a true emergency to stabilize the pet, and then we can provide a no-interest loan where the owner can pay it back at their convenience if it's something like we need x-rays or setting a limb or something, lots of different things.
Well, let's break that down a little bit. Let's start with the basic idea of spaying and neutering. And do people bring their animals into you? Do you go out and find them?
Kind of a little bit of both. We do work with feral cat colonies, but also when people bring in their animals, it's one of the requirements for us to help is that it will be spayed or neutered. We offer for cats very low cost, $20 spays and neuters, and it helps reduce animal suffering. They get loose and then they're homeless cats or dogs, and they just start spreading and the problem gets worse. And then they suffer as well. Spaying and neutering is something that I think is really important for pets in general. And it's something we push very hard and we work hard to try to make sure it gets done properly.
So if the parents or the families can't afford this, are they able to get some assistance from you also?
Yes. If we help financially with something and the animal isn't spayed or neutered, we will also help with the spay or neuter. And if it's something, even if it's just a spay or neuter you're bringing in, we can help with that as well. We team up with the Feline Network, like I said, and we do a copay situation. It's $20 for a neuter and $40 for a spay, I believe. I mean, if you know how much spays and neuters go for, generally it can be in the hundreds.
Right. That is a great assistance. And it seems like you also provide more food, sometimes fostering, adoption services.
We do have a very active foster program, trying to find home for cats and dogs. Just kind of as a quick aside, we are looking for more foster families at the moment, but we do have a lot of dedicated foster families that we work with. And it's great because, again, it helps us get cats and dogs ready to be adopted by their owners in the future.
What would it take to be a foster family?
Well, we have an online application. It's fairly straightforward. If you have the space, you have the room, if you have a little bit of experience. If you don't, I'm sure one of our volunteers will be able to assist you and talk to you and kind of train you up a little bit. AINfund.org. So like Animals in Need Fund, the first letters of that, AINfund.org.
And you also do something with microchipping.
Microchipping is a microchip. So if the animal gets lost, anywhere it gets brought into, whether it's a veterinarian clinic or a animal shelter or anything, they can scan it and then they can call you and let you know they have your pet. And you, so you know where it is and you can come find it. So yeah, we do help with microchipping, and we do actually have coming up on February 20th next year, we are going to have a big low cost spay neuter vaccine and microchipping clinic. We're getting ready for it.
Okay, for February in 2022. So Eric, you are the executive director at the Animals in Need Fund. Tell us if you have more staff or volunteers that help you out.
I'm actually the only paid employee at the nonprofit. We have a system of volunteers that helps us quite a bit. And also everyone on the board is extremely helpful. Well, we have a veterinarian on the board and we have a vet tech on the board. All the work that they do is above and beyond. It's actually quite amazing. But our volunteer network is excellent. Yeah, it helps keep us going.
So do you actually have a physical location where people can actually come and either get the pets or they can bring them?
Yeah, so we mostly work out of Napomo Dog and Cat Hospital. That's the physical location if you need to see us, if you need to meet us. Although generally we're kind of on the move as things are nowadays. I can be anywhere in the county for meetings or anything like that.
If you are just joining us, this is Dr. Consuelo Mukes. I'm your host with The Nonprofit Story. I'm speaking with Eric Rehm. He is the executive director of Animals in Need Fund. So Eric, you said that you used to just be pretty much in Napomo, but it sounds like you are all over the place now. So you serve anywhere in the county, outside the county? What's your area?
At the moment, we're in the county. I'd like to personally expand it to all of California, but we need to be careful about how we expand, because obviously the more we expand, we need to make sure we're still bringing in enough donations that we can service people. Mm-hmm. At the moment, we have working directly with us two clinics in South County, two clinics in North County, and an emergency clinic. So we're sort of close to anybody who needs it in the county. So Napomo Dog and Cat Hospital in Napomo, Mission Animal Hospital in San Luis Obispo, Main Street Animal Hospital in Templeton, El Camino Hospital in Atascadero, and Central Coast Pet Emergency Center in Arroyo Grande, if it's a true emergency. Although El Camino, I believe, can take emergencies as well.
And when you say that you are working with them or partnering with them, what is that partnership that you have with them?
So it's essentially just kind of a streamlining of the process. It's so they know who we are when we call them and talk to them, and they know how our process works so that we can properly pay them if someone comes in and needs financial assistance. If someone doesn't know who we are, sometimes it can be a little tricky, especially if it's an emergency or something and the pet needs help now. But if we've talked to them and we've kind of got them on board with us, then the process is very simple, very quick.
Let's talk a little bit about the adoption process. I noticed on your site, and people can go there and see that you do talk about adoptions and adoption fees. How do adoptions work? How can people get that wonderful pet in their home?
So that is generally done through the foster, or if we bring on an animal that was surrendered to us. And again, that's very simple. We have an online form to do it. Very simple fees we can help with if you need it. I mean, it's all kind of 1, 2, 3. It's hard mm-hmm. to describe it with words, but if you just go through the form, it's all right there in front of you.
And I noticed on your website, you had some nice videos of different animals, the dogs and the cats ready to be adopted also.
Yeah, that's taken by Libby, one of our board members, and she's fantastic. The amount of work she does is amazing. We've asked her a couple times if we could get her on the payroll just because she does so much work, and every time she says no.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I bet those videos are a lot of help. People should go to your website and take a look at them. They're just adorable with those animals that you have. And the other interesting thing is your resource section, where you help people to learn how to acclimate a new animal into the house, the dogs and the cats. Very interesting. I mean, it's just like children, I think, in some way.
Yeah, so a lot of, like I said, our board members are very experienced with animals, veterinary practice, or just been around animals their whole lives. They know what they're talking about. And so they compiled all of these just things. Yeah, kitten teething, things like that. We're also available if you need some extra help. You can always call us or email us, and we can talk as well. But the resources are very complete. It's written by people who really know what they're talking about. And like we were talking about, not just kitten teething, but introducing new cats and dogs into your home. If you have other cats or dogs, which of course anybody who's got more than a couple of pets knows how difficult that can turn out to be. Yeah, all sorts of things. It's really great. Even down to like what plants are poisonous and not for a cat.
Yeah. That was really interesting to see about the plants.
Yeah, it's amazing how many plants are poisonous to cats that you would never think is very common mm-hmm. things.
Yeah, that's what resource that is. And also the other thing about the cat teething period, that was kind of interesting. No wonder they're always trying to bite you.
Yeah, really.
Let's talk now about some of the loans and the money aspects, because I think you're really big on that with helping people to be able to afford these services. And you do have loans for animal care. Mm-hmm. And what are some qualifications that people would need to have to get a loan from you?
So the way it works is we only pay the vet. So anybody who's listening who wants us to pay them, that's not going to happen. We only pay the veterinarian. We need a estimate from the veterinarian, although you can call us and tell us you have a problem and you're not sure if you can afford it, and we can recommend you take it to a specific veterinarian, and then we can talk to them and make sure things get worked out. But otherwise, again, it's just a form. We do require that you have either used up all of your care credit or have been rejected by care credit, which is they're kind of like a credit card company that deals with this kind of thing. But other than that, send in your form, and it's usually me or Libby who sees it, and we'll discuss it amongst the board and very quickly get back to you, usually less than 24 hours.
Are there any services that can be requested through that?
If you really want to request a service, I would call us. I think it's helpful to call first anyway, so we know what to look for and we know what's coming. If you need help filling out the form, I can help you out with that. If it's an emergency, the dog got hit by a car and it just needs to be stabilized now, we can also just provide that, not even a loan, just as a grant. And we'll talk to the vet. And a lot of times the vets will give us a little bit of a discount and stuff too to help, because a lot of the vets we work with are very compassionate towards people who need help, as well as pets. I mean, they get into the business because they love animals. So,
right.
So kind of anywhere you are in the county, if you give us a call, we can direct you somewhere that's close to you that can help you.
You know, there's another service and information that you had on the website, working with the homeless.
Yes.
And helping them with their animals. And as it said on the website, sometimes we see the homeless people that may have a dog and think, what are they doing with this animal? Very good information on your site. Tell us what you have found about the homeless and their pets.
I mean, the homeless love their pets like anybody else does. And oftentimes they're coming from a very tough situation. And we'll work with Five Cities Homeless Coalition to provide the money needed to help their animal. A lot of homeless too, we've had them, once they get back on their feet, they send us back the money we spent, you know? I mean, it's very kind. They're always very appreciative, and yeah, it's wonderful helping them out. People kind of down on their luck and who need some extra assistance.
Do you find that there are special needs with animals that are with the homeless?
Sometimes it's because the animal might live outdoors more often or something like that. But generally, it's not too different than an animal that's with somebody that is housed.
Let's talk a bit about the donations and what you need in order to keep going and provide these services.
When we were just at one clinic, we would spend about $70,000 a year helping people just at that one clinic. And now we're at five, and we would like to expand from not just throughout the entire county, but ideally in my view, I would love to expand throughout California. And so, of course, we need donations to do that. The more donations we get, the more people we can help. I mean, that's who it goes directly to.
Mm-hmm. So donations, then tell us, because Animals in Need Fund, are you pretty much the only type of nonprofit of this sort in the area or in the state?
As far as I know, we pretty much are. The ASPCA in San Francisco used to have a program, but they discontinued it last year. But otherwise, as far as I know, this is it.
So yeah, then you definitely do need some funds to help people. It talks about the Legacy Club on your site, and I'm sure you have that one and maybe other ways people can give.
Well, you can always just do a normal donation. The Legacy Club is a $25 or a $50 every month kind of club that it just automatically sends $25 a month to us. And you get some perks, like you get some tickets to any of our events. You get t-shirts, things like that. It's just a great way to kind of continuously donate, and you don't really have to think about it or anything. It's only $25. It's not very much, but it does make a big difference to us. Like I said, even a neuter for a cat, it costs us $20, right? So mm-hmm. a $25 donation once a month, that's an extra neuter every mm-hmm. month.
How many animals do you serve a month? Or annually? I mean, yeah, a lot.
Yeah. yeah. Annually, I mean, even just spays and neuters were about 450 to 500 per year. And wow. I mean, we do a lot of loans. Oh man, I think right now, like at this moment, I'm working on 6 or 7 that came in the last week. It's quite a bit. Yeah.
Those are loan requests that have come in.
Yeah, exactly. And people that I've been talking to and clinics that I've been calling and talking to them.
Wow. So has this slowed down because of COVID? Sped up? Tell us about that.
Like work has slowed down for a lot of people, or people are maybe underemployed compared to what they used to be before COVID. It's become harder and harder for people to pay veterinary care. And of course, costs rise in veterinary care as well, as it becomes harder for them. So we come in, we can help more people out.
People having some hardships, it means hardships with the animals also. So do you have a relationship, I think, with a Petco organization?
Yeah, we do work with Petco a little bit. We do adoptions through them as well, but they also help us with some food and some grants and things like that. Yeah, absolutely.
So Eric, tell people how to get in touch with you.
So our website again is ainfund.org. You can go there and we have everything you need there, or you can even just email us if you'd like. It's info.ainfund@gmail.com. And, if you just email that straight, it'll probably be me who gets back to you, and we can talk further about it.
That's Animals in Need Fund, ainfund.org. I've been speaking with Eric Rehm. He is the executive director of the program Animals in Need Fund, a 501c3 corporation that's dedicated to the health and well-being of cats and dogs. Eric, thank you for coming on the Nonprofit Story today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this is Dr. Consuelo Mukes. This is the Nonprofit Story.
On today's Working Lunch, the Slow Chamber's Jim D'Antona has a conversation with Framework's Ali Jensen about being the second generation owner of a business. And I'll note that Framework's is a supporter of KCBX.
Good afternoon. This is Jim D'Antona for the Chamber's Working Lunch weekly series, where we talk with community leaders, getting to know the person behind the work. Today, we'll be having a conversation with Ali Jensen, the second generation owner of Frameworks, a custom picture framing studio and art gallery. I'm excited to talk to Ali about the process of taking over the family business and how she sees the future of the industry. Ali, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. Fortunately, I live right above the shop, so that was just like a quick jaunt up the stairs, get set up, and I'm here.
That is the ideal commute. Well, you know, we always enjoy getting to know how people came to the Central Coast. You were born and raised here. So were your parents the ones to find the Central Coast, or was it earlier generation?
So they were living in Southern California, and it was the 70s, and they were total hippies and had this idealized version of coming up to the coast and living in Big Sur and living off the land. And so they got up here and they started looking for property, and they realized they couldn't afford property in Big Sur. So they just went inland, and they kept going more and more inland until we landed in Creston. And so that's where I grew up as a kid. And then we moved into town when I was in school.
And then time in Creston, or was there some other kind of idea?
At that time, my mom was a dental hygienist here in town. And then my dad was managing a cattle ranch out on Highway 58. And then they realized that they wanted to start a business and started talking around, and they got some good advice to start a picture framing business. We had other family members that were picture framers, and they said it was a nice business to be in. When they did open, though, they were one of 13 shops in town, so there was quite a bit of competition.
Thinking about you, one of the stories that I've heard from folks raised here is, I had to get away and see other places. About you going to UCSB. Clearly that wasn't far enough away. You ended up in Florence. Was there a particular draw to that specific place? And what was your life like there?
Well, Florence was amazing. So I had studied art history at UCSB and really focused on Italian Renaissance, which I loved. So I was just in love with all of that art and the culture. And so I had finished up my teaching credential and my master's, and I was like 21 years old, and I was just like, I gotta be like a young 20-year-old and kind of be a little bit irresponsible. So my version of that was going to Italy and working. I mean, Florence was just a wonderful place. I loved it because I remember for my birthday there, I was able to spend time in the Uffizi Gallery looking at Botticelli's Birth of Venus and just be like, happy birthday. This is my view today. It was amazing.
And while you lived there, did you stay just in Italy or were you able to kind of travel around Europe?
Every weekend I traveled somewhere. I made just enough money to support my traveling habits with no savings. It was awesome. You know, you go to Paris for the weekend, you go to London for the weekend, you go to the south of France. It really is such a small continent that can do great weekend trips and feel like you're in a totally different world.
Was there ever a time where you were like 1 year, maybe 20?
Oh, sure. Even now, I'm like, how can I do frameworks and live in Italy? How does that work? I don't know. Yeah.
You eventually came back to Slow County. Yeah. Was the plan to take over the family business when you got back?
No, not at all. I came back and I started teaching and I love teaching. You know, when I left teaching, it wasn't because I didn't enjoy it. I thoroughly enjoyed it. But at that time, my parents were ready to sell their business. And they just bought a sailboat and they were literally sailing off to Mexico and they were going to sell the business and just be done. And I just couldn't let the business leave our family. I don't have siblings. So I realized, okay, if you want to do something, you better jump on it. And so that's when I bought the business from them. And then I think like 2 months later, they literally sailed off into the sunset. And then it was go time.
Your parents may be a whole fascinating discussion. Head off to the North Coast, yeah. Central Coast, to Mexico. But there's a lot of fascinating discussions about multi-generational family businesses. You know, the idea of taking over from your parents and being able to run the business without their constant intrusion, but also being able to ask them for advice on how they dealt with the situation. What was the process like for you? And do you have any words of advice on best practices for making it work?
Gosh, you know, I was fortunate in that they were far enough away that they weren't literally like hovering over my shoulder, watching every move that I made. So I had a lot of freedom that way, but I still had some communication with them where I was able to at least email them once a week and ask them some questions. It's like now been 16 years since I've had the business. I still want to chat with my parents about, you just want a sounding board with ideas of somebody that's had experience in the industry and the business and the clientele. And I still go to my parents to this day just to discuss ideas.
Is their personality one that makes it a little easier to work hands off? Or do you think it's tough for them trying to not be involved?
Probably at some point they've got their opinions, obviously. But I also think they're like peaceful people where it's like, okay, this is the next generation. It's a new chapter. We did what we did, and now it's your turn to go forward. And I'd probably say I earned their respect when going through the economic downturn. Because I remember talking to my parents and they're like, God, we've never experienced anything like that. I'm like, that's not really helping me. Like, I need some encouragement. You know, and they're like, God, that's horrible. I don't know. What are you going to do? And they said, okay, you know what you're doing. You got this.
How long has Framework been in existence? You talked about your parents getting the business started when they got here. How long has it been?
So they started the business on April Fool's, 1990. So we're now at 31 years.
There was a lot of competition back when they started. But that also speaks highly of either the business model, the relationships. Can you talk about the values of the business sure. that have helped you survive?
So when my parents started the business, there was 13 other shops here just in town. And now we're down to like about two. They have always had this approach, and I still have this approach, is to be very friendly with all of the other shops. Like, I want to help them out. I mean, we constantly refer people back and forth. Like, people will send their clients to us because they're like, I don't even want to touch this project. And we're happy to jump in. And so I think having that that friendly relationship is really important. And I think that's something that was started with my parents. It was never like, oh, this is cutthroat competition. It's like, no, we're all in this together. And we really honestly do want to see everybody succeed.
No matter how many businesses I talk to here, event spaces, winemakers, everybody's talking about collaborating or at least knowing there's enough room for everyone.
Absolutely.
How did you start that process to get those relationships that lead to this long-term business?
I think it's just every time somebody is coming in the door, they're bringing in something that's special to them. And so they're being vulnerable and sharing that with me and my staff. And so you develop a deeper relationship that way. And then you earn their trust by making recommendations in terms of like what type of framing material to use, because it's going into their personal space most of the time. It immediately becomes a personal relationship just by the nature of the communication that we have together.
Well, and I would think that your background in art, you know, is extremely helpful in the work you do. I was at Nate's on Marsh the other night, and he told me you helped collaborate on the art in his restaurant. Do you collaborate with artists on your work?
Yeah, that was such a fun project. Nate had commissioned Jerry Scott, a local artist who we represent here in our gallery, to do 6 original paintings for his restaurant. And then we worked with him to do the framing. And it's so much fun to work with other artists and then see their vision come to fruition. And then once, you know, the paintings were framed and up in his space, it's wonderful to see. So I love that.
You're listening to Working Lunch. Today, the Slow Chambers Jim D'Antona is having a conversation with Framework's Allie Jensen.
Can you talk just real quick about the gallery?
So we represent about 3 different local artists on a consistent basis. And then between that, we would host solo shows of a variety of different local artists. And like pre-COVID, we'd probably have like maybe 3 openings a year that we'd time with Art After Dark. But since March of 2020, we haven't actually had any receptions, but we've had probably our highest art sales. People are hungry to buy original artwork. And so it's been awesome to be able to represent these artists and sell their work and get this into great homes. But it's just a weird dynamic. It's not like the typical reception and like putting on that show. It's like, no, people are just coming in and doing it quietly.
I'd love to know from you, is there more to framing than just picking color or style when considering framing?
Yeah, for us, we definitely focus quite a bit on conservation. So we want to be able to protect the artwork for as long as possible. And so that's definitely a conversation that we have with our clients in terms of making recommendations about using conservation mat materials that are like acid-free, lignin-free. We're not using cardboard and things that are going to yellow and damage your artwork. And then also using the appropriate glass. You know, you want glass with UV protection, like most people have got quite a bit of light in their homes. And so we want to make sure that pieces are protected with UV protection. And then of course, we always want to make recommendations for using material that is suitable to hold the artwork and use quality material, because you can build a frame out of all sorts of things, but you want to make sure that you're using good material.
To me, one of the questions that comes up is displaying your art or special prints or whatever they are without framing. I saw an artist the other day and he said, no, I'm not going to let you kind of take this without a frame. I mean, is that
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely like an approach to having a clean, simple aesthetic. And I get that. But like, if you just put a painting up on the wall with no frame, you look at it and you're like, oh, that's really pretty, but it just feels unfinished. And so even if you just put like a simple thin floater frame on it, just something to give it that finished edge, so it just is complete. And then really the whole goal is always to enhance the artwork. So we don't want to be staring at the framing. You know, you want to enhance the artwork.
What's the most interesting piece you framed?
It's fun. You never know what somebody's going to bring in. Literally, you just never know. I think one of my more memorable projects was a gentleman came in and he opened up his little box and he showed it to me. And I have no idea what this is. You know, I can tell we're going to do a shadow box, but what is this? He's like, oh, this is my pacemaker. Oh, tell me more about your pacemaker. And it helped him live this life so far. And he had to swap it out for his upgrade. And he felt like he wanted to honor that pacemaker and frame it. And so we did that. And it's up in his home and hopefully brings him some joy.
You know, I'm curious, as Framework's experience during the pandemic, has the supply chain disruptions been a problem for you?
So at first we were fine. I had no issues, but we've always been like a lagging indicator in terms of our industry. So I was kind of like waiting for it to catch up to us. I would say like early on though, it was really hard for me to get any custom acrylic. So if like we wanted plexiglass on a really large piece and had to have it custom made, it wasn't possible because all of my manufacturers were diverting their attention away from picture framing and towards like PPE for hospitals and other places. So that was interesting. And then I'd say now more recently in the past few months, it's just kind of getting those containers that are sitting off the coast, you know, into port and unloaded and then onto the trucks to be delivered out to us, which I guess is also like, it's another reason to, you know, focus on finding your sources from American-made products. You know, my American-made companies, you know, they're going gangbusters and they're busy, but they're able to fulfill all the orders and not have any issues.
So what was the business like during the pandemic? We've definitely seen more consumption of art, but from your business side, has it just been ups? It's been ups and downs. Well, what it's been like?
A month ago or so, I saw this bumper sticker that I was like, oh, this is exactly it. And it was like the like graph of the heartbeat going up and down. And it said, without the highs and lows, we'd all be dead. And I was like, that's exactly it. Like, that's what I felt like this past, you know, year and a half has been, where we were completely closed for 2 months. And like for the first like week or two, it was like novel. And it was like, okay, I can just finish the projects that I'm in the middle of. I'll finish all these up and then I can go deliver them to all my clients. But then like reality came crashing in and it was like, we're having no new business coming in. And I was like that was paralyzing. And so that was extremely challenging those 2 months. And, you know, fortunately I had some great relationships with local bankers and was able to talk to them and get support and get our funding. And so through the PPP and EIDL and just, I'd say really though, what was great about it was actually being able to have phone conversations with our local bankers. It wasn't like I had to send some email to corporate trying to get somebody to talk to me. Like I could have a personal conversation to help me figure out the finances, but also just, I need some words of encouragement, you know? And that's where also I'd lean on my other, you know, fellow friends that are business owners. I remember talking to Kimberly Walker every day. We'd like kind of check in and be like, okay, what fire are you putting out today? Like, what are we going to do? Like, how are we going to solve this? What are we going to do? And so that kind of like fed my energy to go come back and come back stronger. So that by the time we were able to reopen, we were ready to go. And then business started coming back in and now we've been really busy, fortunately. So I'm thankful.
You talked earlier about the acrylic piece, but you had to compete with hospitals. How does one even make an argument to compete with the hospitals?
Fortunately, again, I work with fantastic clients that have good perspective. Once I explain that to them, they're like, oh God, yeah, I get it.
You talked about, again, you want to use wood in all yours, and we've been hearing from construction companies.
Yes.
Were there other surprising competitors for products that you were getting?
I think it was just really that acrylic. But then it kind of ended up being fun too, because we'd get pieces that would come in acrylic and we were reframing them. And instead of putting that acrylic in the trash, I would just put it on like Facebook Marketplace for free. We had people coming all the time to come pick up these used pieces of acrylic that were great for like a partition somewhere, like horrible for framing, but it was a great way to kind of pay that forward.
I know you have young children. Do you hope one day they will take over the business?
You know, I think the best approach that my parents did were they gave me no pressure. There was zero pressure or talk about me taking it over. And so that encouraged me to do my own thing and then to make my own decision to jump into the business. My parents definitely modeled the joy of the business to me. It's a really good business. You know, you're not going to make millions of dollars in it, but I can support my family. I can support my lifestyle. I can contribute and participate in our community. And I've got great coworkers and clients. So the quality of life is great in this business. And I think that's something that my children can see now with us. And it'll be up to them whether they want to take it over. It would be interesting to see them compete. Are they both going to take it over? Like, I don't know. We'll see.
Is there one that seems like the one who is more interested?
I will say that they both like the business aspect side of it, of going to the bank and doing the bank deposit, because you get stickers and lollipops every time you go drop off your money. Sure. Depends on how much money you're dropping off, you know?
Allie, thank you so much for being here. It's been terrific learning more about you, your family, and Frameworks. Really appreciate you being here today.
Thanks, Jim.
Frameworks is a supporter of KCBX. And finally, this afternoon, we're re-airing a 2019 episode of Playing with Food from our archives in celebration of Hanukkah.
This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food.
Hanukkah, Hanukkah, Chag Yafe Kol Kach, Or Chavim Misavim Gilei Yeled Rach. Hanukkah, Hanukkah, Zevivon Sof Sof. Sof Sof Sof, Sof Sof Sof, Ma Naim Ve Tov.
Hanukkah is the Jewish Festival of Lights. As with every Jewish holiday, symbolic food prominently features in celebrations. Since the observance recalls the miracle of one day's supply of lamp oil lasting a full 8 days, oil takes center stage in the preparation of the holiday treats. I ventured down to my local synagogue where they were preparing the most famous of Hanukkah treats, the latke. It was a busy and lively latke factory. Robin, the office manager for Congregation Beth David in San Luis Obispo, introduced me to the day's volunteers.
I refer to the cooks that come into our synagogue as the Guild of Jewish Grandmothers, because they all come in with a wealth of experience and some history behind them and their family history, and they bring it together, and all of that together becomes this most amazing group of people cooking in our kitchen. And we do have some grandfathers that cook too, so I guess I could call them the Guild of Jewish Grandparents.
My name is Judy, and I'm the principal of the religious school, Beth David School. And this is one of our two fundraisers for the year. We have one for Hanukkah. We sell frozen dozen latkes, and then we have a Hanukkah party. Then at Purim time, we have a Purim carnival, and we sell humintashen. So we get the grandmas baking at Purim time, and the grandmas making latkes for Hanukkah.
Amira. And I'm Judy's assistant at the religious school.
I'm Janice Gope. I'm in charge of membership for the congregation.
And then, with all the sounds and smells of frying food and good friends sharing the conversation, we got down to learning about and the business of making these delicious Hanukkah potato pancakes.
A latke is a potato pancake. It has German background. Many of the Jews came from the Germanic countries. So I guess this is one of the Hanukkah traditions of Jewish people. It's made with grated potatoes, grated onions, salt, matzah meal, and eggs.
Why do you have latkes at Hanukkah?
Because of the oil. There's the Hanukkah story where the temple was destroyed and there was only enough oil to last for one day. And a miracle happened in that it was able to keep the eternal light of the Nir Tamid burning for the full 8 days until they were able to get more oil. So the tradition is to eat foods that are cooked in oil, like potato pancakes, latkes, and jelly donuts.
The Jews and Israelites go back thousands of years, right? But potatoes come from South America, so how? These haven't been going since the first Hanukkah.
Neither did jelly donuts.
Well, potatoes come from South America.
Originally.
Yeah, originally.
But they somehow got to Eastern Europe. Yeah.
According to that well-known online encyclopedia, latkes are an adaptation of the ancient Israelite fried pancake made with lentils, eaten by Jews several thousand years ago. Then, cheese latkes were common among the Ashkenazi communities until the 19th century, which is when the potato arrived in Eastern Europe. And the rest is history. According to the New Complete International Jewish Cookbook by Evelyn Rose, latkes were originally made with cheese, but since Hanukkah falls in December when milk supplies are low, Eastern European Jews began using potatoes instead of cheese.
Here's our recipe. We grate the potatoes, and then we soak them in an ice bath. What that does is removes a lot of the potato starch.
Oh, look at that. The whole bottom of that bowl has a film of potato starch in it.
So the potato starch runs out, and that's what makes them crisper.
Oh, okay.
So then we squeeze as much of the moisture out as we can, and then we mix it with eggs, matzah meal, salt, chopped onions.
Okay.
And we mix up a batter, and then we fry it and drain, you know, the oil off as much as we can, and then we pack them up.
That sounds pretty simple.
It is.
Okay. Can you make it more complicated for a longer radio show?
No.
Well, but then it's how you eat them.
Okay. We'll get to how you eat them in a minute. So Yukon Gold. Why Yukon Gold?
Then we don't have to peel them. Skin, yeah, it's thinner, and they're a nice texture for potato pancakes. But people use all different kinds. You can even make sweet potato latkes.
Yeah.
What do you make at home?
This is the recipe I use at home.
So here you are frying them.
Yeah.
How big are they?
They're bigger than a silver dollar. We use a tablespoon to put them on.
So an oversized tablespoon.
Yeah, but some people, like my husband, makes these giant ones. We like them this size.
So they're about 2.5 inches across, about a half an inch thick.
Yeah.
How long do they take to cook?
Not very long. Depends on how hot the frying pan is.
Yeah, this one's smoking over here.
Right, I have to shut it off. And there's only a little left.
Have you ever set off the smoke alarm?
In my house, all the time.
Can you do it in a deep fryer?
I don't know.
No, it has to be a shallow pan with about half.
I wonder if you can do it in a...
They would fall apart. You know, they just, if you had them floating in a big pot of oil, they would just disperse.
The Guild of Jewish Grandmothers transform 15 pounds of potatoes into 15 dozen latkes over 7 days using the miracle of oil.
Some of us like them with applesauce, and others like them with sour cream. And what else?
Some like it with both.
Caviar. We weren't that formal. There would be a jar of applesauce and a container of sour cream, and people put whatever they wanted on it.
Yeah. So we would go to my grandparents every year for Hanukkah. And when we walked through the door of their little home in Burbank, the smell of latkes was just, and brisket, my grandmother's fantastic brisket. And we would walk in and immediately all of the grandkids, all three of us would be in the kitchen just like begging for a latke, which of course she would give us one before dinner. We would light the menorah and then sit down for dinner, and we would have this huge table with all of this traditional Eastern European food and latkes for Hanukkah. My grandmother would make extras, and she would send us each home with extras, and we would eat them in the car home. They were so good, and they're fantastic the next morning.
Can I taste one?
Oh, I don't know, Judy. What do you think?
Do you have any applesauce or sour cream?
No.
You don't?
Everybody's hoarding their sour cream.
Yeah.
You gotta start stocking up early for Hanukkah.
I had some, I don't know where it went.
No applesauce, do I have to try a plain one?
You're just gonna have to eat
it. I'm gonna have to try a plain one. Okay, I can try a plain one. So this is a freshly made latke.
Right.
Made by the Guild of Jewish Grandmothers here at Congregation Beth David.
Right.
Here you go. Mmm, it's very nice. Mm-hmm. I love all form of deep fried potato products, so there was no way that I wasn't gonna like it.
Applesauce versus sour cream. Applesauce or sour cream. It's the choice you're gonna have to make. Which to put on your potato cakes.
You don't eat these 8 days in a row?
You would feel sick.
I don't think I'd feel sick. I think it'd be
worse. It's labor intensive too. Nobody, unless you buy them.
Yeah, you can buy them.
A good latke is crispy on the outside and soft on the inside. Yeah. Fully cooked all the way through. A little salty. My kids like them with the edge super crisp.
Amira, every single one of yours is the same color of golden brown.
Oh, gosh.
This is amazing.
The electric skillet.
That's patience as well.
Yeah.
The electric
skillet.
Yeah,
I have a lot of patience.
You have a lot of patience.
Oh,
beautiful.
Yes.
Can I have one more? Can I take one more?
Can I
take one?
Can I turn the fan back on?
It's kind of like hash brown.
Do you think they're related?
Well, it's basically the same idea, except the hash browns don't have the egg and the matzo meal.
Do you think that latkes are the precursor to the hash brown?
I have no idea.
Maybe we'll have to look that up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Except hash browns are not in a cake.
Oh, real ones are. When you go to a diner, they look exactly like this, but they're bigger.
Oh.
Yeah. Maybe. They're freeform.
Maybe they copied us.
That's what I think. I think some Jew started a diner and made big latkes, and somebody said, hey, I like those.
Yeah, could be.
The hash brown came to America in the late 1800s and is a derivative of the rosti, a potato pancake from Bern, Switzerland. The latkes were delicious, and whether you are celebrating Hanukkah or not, give them a try, either in your kitchen or from the frozen food section. Or if you're really lucky, get an invitation to a Hanukkah celebration by one of the Guild of Jewish Grandmothers at Congregation Beth David.
You're listening to an episode of Playing with Food from our archives. This Hanukkah show first aired on KCBX in December 2019.
But latkes aren't the only Hanukkah treat. Amira, who is from Israel, told me about another oily tradition.
My name is Amira. Those are the jelly donuts, and in Hebrew, sufganiyot. I'm from Israel, and Israel is a very secular country. We didn't spend a lot of time in synagogues, but I did grow up with Hanukkah. We did eat latkes and the sufganiyot, but we didn't make them at home.
The traditional is to inject inside strawberry jelly. They even make it with chocolate these days.
Does that count?
Yeah, it's not traditional, but it's count. Chocolate always counts. We have the menorah at home, so we do the candles. We buy the donuts. We don't make them because it's only me and him, and we watch our diets. Because this is a lot of oil, and as you know, the Jewish holidays, there's a lot of eating, so, and there's a lot of holidays, so I have to watch it.
I got the full story of the Hanukkah donut from Atascadero native and food blogger Tori Avey on a sketchy phone line.
My name is Tori Avey, and I am a food blogger. I have a food website called toriavey.com, and I explore the history of various foods, culinary traditions. I tend to focus on the Middle East and Mediterranean. I explore a lot of Israeli food.
I can't really pronounce it, but there's donuts that are eaten at Hanukkah.
Yes, they're called sufganiyot.
Sufganiyot.
You might be more familiar with like a jelly donut at the bakery. That's basically what it is. It's a fried jelly donut, usually with a dusting of sugar or powdered sugar. Over time, it's actually become popular to have different kinds of fillings. So you'll find them filled with custard or Nutella or, you know, various sweet fillings. But generally speaking, the most popular is strawberry or a berry jam. If you want to go back really far, you're going to be going to Germany to the German cookbook that was written in 1532 called Küchenmeisterei, which is mastery of the kitchen. That was really where the first recipe for what might be considered a jelly donut. Basically, the recipe was two round pieces of bread sandwiched around a sweet jam filling and then fried in lard.
I'm assuming that that wasn't used for Hanukkah because it was done in lard.
You're absolutely right. When that recipe was published, it became very popular throughout Europe. Jewish populations throughout Europe decided to fry the treat in goose fat or in chicken fat, which is called schmaltz. And then it kind of evolved as a lot of Jews moved to, well, they made aliyah to Israel because of the rising anti-Semitism prior to World War II. And they brought their own version of jelly donuts with them. And in Israel, there was already a tradition for Hanukkah. North African Jews would make these deep fried donuts called sfenj. There were also Sephardic Jews that had their own fried donut tradition. So there were all of these donut traditions throughout Israel, and the jelly donuts came from Eastern Europe, and then something interesting happened. There's a labor union called Histadrut in Israel, and they kind of popularized the idea of jelly donuts for the Hanukkah holiday, because the most popular treat you probably know of for Hanukkah is called latkes. They're very easy to make. You can make them at home. So this labor union was looking for something that was a little more complex to make so that people wouldn't be so tempted to make them at home that they would actually have to go out and buy them. And that would in turn stimulate the economy in Israel because people needed employment throughout the holidays. If you've ever tried to make donuts, it's really tricky. It's not an easy thing to do. In fact, you know, I cook. That's what I do. And for years, the right recipe eluded me. I tried so many recipes from so many Jewish cookbooks, and I just never found one that tasted like it came from bakery. So I just bought them for many years. But this year is the first year that I'm actually posting my recipe for sufganiyot because I finally figured it out. And it took a lot of trial and error, and I still encourage people to go to the bakery because it's not easy. To be perfectly honest, Hanukkah is not one of the most significant Jewish holidays. It's taken on significance because of its proximity to Christmas. And I think American Jews wanted to take part more in the holiday season. And so it became a more important holiday because of that. But generally speaking, there's really no wrong way to celebrate it as long as you're giving significance to this historical story and frying something. In our family, we tend to do the first night, we light the candle of the menorah. We bring family and friends from all different faiths and backgrounds together to celebrate with us. And we always have sufganiyot, generally from the bakery, because I just don't have time to cook them. Although this year I'm going to be making them because I finally mastered this recipe. It's a beautiful way to get together and celebrate family and celebrate traditions and celebrate centuries-old stories and share the story with the family and friends. But the fried food is the best part.
And there are easier ways to do this at home with slight modifications.
So we make these, they're called levivot, which is really just kind of a Hebrew word for fried treats. But these little treats are more like beignets, and they're much easier to make than sufganiyot. They're risen with baking powder rather than yeast that are fried, like the soup and yodar, but they take on these really cool shapes, and you can drizzle them with a sugar syrup or honey. My particular favorite is like a chocolate fudge sauce that we drizzle it with, and it's just decadent. It's really delicious.
Now it is time to taste a jelly donut, so I found someone with Israeli Jewish heritage for a conversation over a donut and coffee.
My name is Nachshon Margalit, and I'm part of Congregation Or Tzafon. I'm here to enjoy a donut with Father Ian.
If this were to be Hanukkah, what should I order as my donut?
So typically you'd order something called the sufganiya, which sufganiyot are a round jelly-filled or custard-filled donut with powdered sugar traditionally. So let's see if they have any.
Okay, well, there's filled donuts right here. And look, there's one with powdered sugar on it. There's one with chocolate, and there's one glazed, and one with sugar on it. So
perfect. That looks like sufganiyot.
Okay. Oh, they actually have sufganiyot.
Yeah, they sure do. Yeah.
We should order one of those.
Okay.
And they have, like, Star of David, and they have menorahs on them, and they have dreidels on them.
Very cool.
I'm going to have a sufganiyot and whatever the gentleman would like.
And I'll also have a sufganiyot. Maybe I'll take a dreidel-shaped one, and
I'll have a menorah one.
Great.
Yeah. Are you selling a lot of these?
Yeah, they go by pretty quick. The powdered sugar tastes really good on top of it. Anything else for you?
Do you want some coffee or anything?
Take a black coffee, please.
I'll have a small coffee as well. I've got a menorah-shaped donut. What do you say?
Yeah, Mazel tov.
L'chaim. L'chaim.
There we go.
So I'm going to try this. It's nice.
It's very good. I would say the batter on this is a little more cakey, but it's very tasty.
Yeah, it is tasty. Yours has more jelly in it because yours was like an even kind of shape as a dreidel. And as a menorah that looked kind of like an hourglass, I didn't get this much jelly.
You should be jealous.
Is this traditional?
In Israel, around Hanukkah, most bakeries, donut shops, etc., they're going to pull a lot of the other product out and they're going to fill the shelves with sufganiyot. Eating fried food is tradition for Hanukkah. There's so much sufganiyot making in Israel around Hanukkah that you can literally like smell the wonderful smells in the air walking around because they're just for sale everywhere. I would say strawberries and custard fillings, really any kind of filling. When I was a kid, I really wasn't into the fillings. I'd look for the ones with no filling, but this is good. For me, the memories are my mom making sufganiyot at home. So after we would have dinner on one of the nights of Hanukkah, she would have the batter pre-made from earlier in the day. She would heat up the oil and basically make us fresh sufganiyot, which is something that I intend to pass down to my kids as well. I have in the past made them. I wouldn't say they were successful, but I'm gonna try again. Making a round donut ball in oil worked fine, but getting them filled with the jelly and getting the jelly to stay inside seemed to be a little rough. I'm gonna try this here, yeah.
Okay.
With the sufganiyot, no, there's nothing more specific. A more religious family would say a prayer before eating the meal in general, but nothing specifically for sufganiyot.
And would you do this while you're lighting the candle?
You absolutely could eat sufganiyot while lighting the candles, but again, it's more of a dessert item, so it's probably after the meal. You may light the candles after the meal and then have dessert. You may light the candles before the meal. I don't know that the ritual has a specific order.
Oh, dreidel, 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 now dreidel I shall play.
These oil-fried treats are delightful. They can be found in bakeries, stores, and homes all along the Central Coast. Finally, for the person who doesn't have a Hanukkah tradition and who only knows that there is a candelabra called a menorah and a toy called a dreidel, Tori had a great analogy to explain the holiday.
Somebody put it to me in modern terms the other day. They said it's like if you had a cell phone that had 10% charge and it lasted 8 days. That's how to put it in perspective for, you know, today's folks.
Oh, dreidel, 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 now dreidel, I shall play.
Happy Hanukkah. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food.
This Hanukkah show first aired on KCBX in December 2019. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.